Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain. We know the kind of country and world we want to live in, from having a livable wage to having a livable planet. Although we're unlikely to make progress on those issues on the national level until we change elected officials in Washington, D.C., we can make progress now through other channels. Imagine harnessing capital to create the world we want. An increasing number of investors and customers are directing their dollars to companies that are environmentally and socially responsible. More and more business leaders are responding to this growing trend. Our guest today is a leader in the movement of individuals and institutions who are investing in ways aligned with their values and thereby directing capital to create the world we want. Tom Mitchell is Managing Director at Cambridge Associates in Arlington, Virginia. Tom Mitchell, welcome to All Together Now.
Eleanor, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you and your listeners today. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this conversation because I think you're really in a pivotal point at making the changes we need in our country and our world. So thank you for being here. You help people who want to invest their money in companies that are doing the right thing without sacrificing returns on investment. Tell our listeners, what is impact investing?
So impact investing is something that, as a phrase, I think has probably come more into common parlance over the last decade, but I really think it reflects a progression of what you could call responsible investing that extends more than just decades, but even really centuries. If you go back, if you're in the U.S., even to some of the founding principles of some of the religious organizations that helped establish some of the initial colonies here in what became the United States. But in more contemporary times, there's been a movement really since the 60s to look at, consider both environmental, social, and governance factors in investing. And I think that the best way to express that, the most accessible way to express that in the 60s and 70s, say, was through exclusions of companies that weren't aligned with investors' values or move counter to them.
Back then it was called socially responsible investing, right?
That's right. That's right. And this does really get confusing with the vocabulary around this. But I think SRI really evolved from being very exclusion driven to, as data got better and more insight and information to the companies because of the growing field and seeking disclosures from corporations, both by investors or third party watchdog groups, we moved into an area into the 90s and early 2000s where you not only had the ability to exclude, but to also proactively include those companies that have the characteristics and attributes that people thought, that they thought were driving positive change. And then where I think, so to get to the question of impact investing, what that is I think it stands on the shoulders of what's preceded it in investing, but is where investors really look at a situation and say there's either a market, a company, a community that we think that we can drive change in any of those places through capital allocation. And so that can be helping establish that market, empower that community, or influence that company through investments. And that's where people are seeking this measurable impact, if you will. To our mind, and the clients we work with, impact investing means a lot of things, but I would say that simply it is moving with intent to shape, in effect, a market or an enterprise through your allocation of capital. So we really think that the key point is the intention of the investor.
Right. And basically, the intention is that people want to support what they care about through their investments and still make money from doing it, right?
That's true.
So I know people are have a lot of different things they care about that they have in mind. So obviously the field is very diverse here in impact investing. Some people care about addressing climate change. Others want to foster the sustainable communities. Others want to deal with the income inequality and wealth inequality across the country and the world. What are some of the specific things you see investors are supporting with their with their investment money.
Sure. Yeah, I think, you know, if we drew the had to bisect the investment universe into two, the impact investment universe to two different sides, they certainly aren't mutually exclusive in any way, shape, or form. But to paint it with a broad brush, you could look along the areas of environmental sustainability or what we call social progress. And if we look along the environmental sustainability side, we see people investing in things related to energy systems. So that's can be renewable energy infrastructure or smart power, sustainable transportation, for example. They're investing in the built environment. So a large percentage of the carbon emissions that we experience on an annual basis, say globally, are coming from buildings and their operations. So looking for efficiency of those buildings, looking for efficient use of water, certainly a scarce resource, and looking to reduce waste. We waste a lot of precious natural resources like water in our economic activities and our industrial activities and agricultural activities, but we also waste a lot of things like food as well. Food mm-hmm. systems is another area where investors are looking at sustainable agriculture, not only for the sustainability of its use of natural resources, but looking to improve food security and the quality and healthiness of the food that's being grown. And then all of that would be underpinned by land and water. So we're seeing in the environmental area, let's say, of investors that are investing across the environmental and social, we're seeing more than half the amount of capital in recent years going toward things that have some explicit environmental goals. On the social side, I think social justice is a very big issue, and this relates to racial inequality and income inequality. And a lot of that involved, and so there's a lot of investors really digging deep to understand what they own and why, and what are the uses of proceeds of their investments, be that into a stock, an equity investment, or a bond, a debt investment. Education is very important, particularly mm-hmm. as we think about we're in a world with a rapidly growing population and a high rate of innovation, and there are people that face real risk of being left behind or being caught in these widening gaps around racial and income inequality. And so education is a key to advancing and adapting in an ever-changing world. And there's a lot of interesting technologies that are helping both foster education not only in the primary or secondary level for children, but also continuing education and workforce development. Some fascinating things there. Health and wellness is a big issue. So that's everything from access to healthcare to health and IT infrastructure. And an area that certainly emerged since you invoked the election and has become a topic of conversation since then, which I think people are seeking investment solutions and also philanthropic solutions, is around civic practices. Mm-hmm. So having healthier civic engagement, looking to fortify the notion of a free press and developing information sources that people can trust and rely upon, and focusing on democratic practices and anti-corruption.
Wow, I haven't heard that one before. You know, if I'm an investor, how would I direct my money to reduce corruption and increase freedom of the press?
That is a great question. Now you're making me regret even bringing it up, because the answer is one well, that we're still
I just had never heard
on.
It before. It's interesting.
Yeah, you know, I think it's something that's it's crucial, and it overlaps with a lot of other things. But what we have seen, from well-known, or at least what I think are well-known companies, say like a change.org, there are technology-driven companies like that which encourage mm-hmm. civic engagement and interaction and democratic activity, if you will, through technology. Those have venture capital backing
some of
these companies. So there are technology companies like that that are emerging people looking at backing. And then quite frankly, the foundations that I work with will ask a question. Say, what's the best form of capital for an impact they want to pursue? So there could be a financial investment you can make, like I just described, or it could still be good old-fashioned philanthropy and providing grants to organizations and enterprises that can help foster this. So you see both nonprofit and for-profit solutions in that area. And I think we need and will see a lot more mm-hmm. in the time to come.
Yeah, very good. It's an excellent explanation of it. And I connected in back in the 1970s when it was still called socially responsible investing, and you gave a great description of the progression from that. But my layman's interpretation of it is that kind of in the 70s and 80s, you talked about an exclusionary screen, and that would be things like investors would say, don't put my money in any company that sells tobacco or sells guns or is nuclear energy or deals in weapons. So it was really more like a screen that you kind of put across saying, I can put my money in anything but not these things. So you would kind of keep it out of there. And then that scope broadened, as you talked about, where then you'd say something more like, invest in companies that are good on the environmental, social, and governance factors, like treating women fairly, promoting women and people of color, using fair labor practices, pay your workers well, you know, respectful of the environment, you know, kind of more, you know, branching in a little more proactively. And now it's kind of reached the point where with what you're now calling impact investing, that people are actually looking for companies whose very mission is to contribute positively to the world. And you mentioned quite a few of them there, you know, the companies that produce renewable energy or increase energy efficiency, building public transportation or energy efficient buildings, and the whole wonderful roster you named of what we can do. Would you say that's a fair description of the progression on this field?
Yes. Yes, I would, and I think also one thing I would add to that is that when SRI first came in the mainstream and it was more exclusionary, I think that people that were classically trained in finance and investing or working on Wall Street would see that as something quite distinct. You know, there were certain biases in the financial sector against socially responsible investing, and seeing that as a pure screening activity. And where I've seen changes over the last two decades is seeing a lot more, the emergence of more integrated thinking and people understanding that the materiality, if you will, the financial materiality and value of a given enterprise is highly tied to environmental, social, and governance factors.
Right. And I remember, you know, one of the arguments in favor of it was if a company is following these better environmental and governance and social practices, it's kind of a way to limit your risk in the sense that those companies are less likely to be brought down by a major sexual harassment lawsuit or a major environmental lawsuit or some kind of a suit where they end up paying very high fees or penalties or actually even going out of business because of their operating principles.
Yep, that's right. That's right. I mean, I think headline risk, if you will, is what we call is something that certainly motivates many investors looking at that screening and trying to mitigate that. And if you look from just a data standpoint, if you analyze companies with higher ESG qualities versus the market, versus peers in the market with lower ESG qualities, you can see over long periods of time that in periods of negative periods in the stock market or recession or, you know, market declines, you see more buoyancy and resiliency in those stocks with higher ESG scores. And so you do get that better risk management.
Yeah, and when you say ESG for our listeners, that's the environmental, social, governance factors that people are looking at.
Yeah.
Well, I think this is a tremendously exciting development over the past couple of decades where we can actively take our money. I mean, people have thought about it a lot of times in terms of being customers or consumers in a company. You patronize and shop at places where the companies are treating the workers well and not using slave labor, but using fair trade practices and so forth, that you support companies doing the right thing and you stay away from companies that are doing the wrong thing. Now this is bringing it to a whole other level where people who are investors are taking their portfolios and saying, how can I use the capital that I have, the funds available to me, in a way that helps support the world that I want to have? And I see the potential here is for using the capital as the major driver to create the kind of country and world we want.
Yes, Absolutely.
That's exciting because that's what we can control. We don't have to depend on the president or the Congress or anybody else. We can just do that through the money.
Well, yes, you can. I mean, I think, you know, the regulations and policy also help set the rules for markets. So, I mean, nothing exists in isolation. But I do think that, you know, even where I sit, I largely work with institutions and families that have significant amounts of capital. And frankly, they have the ability to influence and drive things in a much greater way than perhaps you or I do as individuals. That said, by far the largest amounts of investment capital reside in, say, individually managed retirement plans, 401ks or 403b plans that most people have, or individual brokerage accounts. And so I think the next big step in impact investing is to increase access for what we call retail investors, or these individuals that aren't well-heeled institutions, to take action. And as that is starting to happen, and the things we're seeing in that space, and I know you and I have discussed this previously, but not with your listeners, that is where I think that potential for the impacts you describe reside greatly in there as well. I mean, it takes all investors to be moving forward and kind of rowing in the same direction, if you will, but really tapping into the power of the individual investor is, I think, the next frontier.
Yeah, and that's this awesome unlimited potential there, huge growth possibilities in it. Now, one of the questions that comes to mind is if people can take their money and direct it towards the kinds of things they want to see in the world, as you've discussed, then why aren't more people doing it? And it seems like the biggest block for people is that they're afraid that the returns they're going to get from having that kind of a focus will be not as high as if they just do something like following the regular, say, a stock market index or something. What do you say to that concern? How do the returns of this kind of investing, impact investing, compare with investments that have no real values consideration and just all about getting high returns?
Sure, and I will try to give you a concise answer appropriate for radio, but tell you that it's a complex topic, and there have been a lot of academic studies around this, and there's no one clear hard answer. But what I will tell you is, having looked at this extensively, as I described earlier, if you're looking at an index, if you will, a passive holding of the stock market. So compare, say, the S&P 500 with one of the most common ESG indices that also tracks the U.S. You get basically two large baskets of stocks, and they'll perform a little bit differently over time because you ultimately end up having a few different stocks in there. But over the long period of time, you tend to see, with good ESG screens applied, better protection in those down periods, i.e. you don't lose as much money, which leads to, on average, in an annualized fashion, a slightly higher performance. Now, there are other indices that screen things a lot of different ways, and you might see slightly lower performance. But if you're talking about just passively investing in the stock market, I don't think there's much of a trade-off. Where the trade-off has resided historically, so this is to throw a bone of fairness to some skeptics, is in the cost of investing. So we all have to go pay a fee to invest in, say, like invest in a mutual fund, for example. And historically, it was much less expensive to buy the standard Vanguard S&P 500 index fund than a screened ESG index fund that did a version of the S&P. And a lot of that had to do with the cost of the research and the extra information that had to be gathering that extra information to apply those screens. Where we are today is the amount of data has improved, technology has improved, and the cost have come down. And so you're finding there's not a cost trade-off like there was in the past. And so when you're looking at just index funds, there's not much trade-off at all. When you look at actively managed funds, where you're trying to, say, go with a stock picker who you think can beat the market, the reality is that your average active manager is not good, whether they're an ESG manager or not. So you have to work really hard to pick a good stock manager. And what we've seen are the number of active managers who we think have real talent and are thoughtful about environmental, social, and governance factors has been steadily increasing over the years, and it's becoming easier to do that. From my perspective, there's no discernible trade-off, and in the areas where it's hard to be successful at investing in general, which is with active management, the choices available to me and my clients, they're much higher than they were in the past. Still need to grow, but are better.
That's a great explanation of a fairly complex question, so I really appreciate that. But the bottom line here is the bottom line that you can now go, if you want to go, as you say, with the more passively invested thing with an index fund, you can get comparable returns now, including the environmental, social, and governance factors, as opposed to just kind of a regular run-of-the-mill stock market index fund. So that's an exciting place to be.
Absolutely. And it's not to be taken lightly. It's been there are people where I appreciate you calling me a leader in the field, and I've certainly devoted 20 years of my career to this, but I've been able to be around people that have been doing it for 20 years longer than me and had to fight those battles and have those arguments in a much more stark contrast in the past. And so we've come a long way in that regard. And all things being held equal, an ESG index fund should outperform over the long term, if even by a slight margin.
Fantastic. And, you mentioned before that it's two different ways for people to support the kinds of companies doing the right thing. One is we've been talking about the investments. The other is through outright philanthropy and making donations. But it really strikes me that people have focused so much on the philanthropic side, but most foundations are required by law to give away something like 5% of their assets a year. That means they've got 95% of their assets are sitting in portfolios invested somewhere. But the amount of attention given to where is that 5% going to go that's being given away in philanthropy versus what is the impact of the 95% that they're holding in the portfolios, I don't see as much attention being given to that. Is that what you see? And how do we get more attention to institutions particularly or people who have wealth and have a foundation to get them to focus more on where is my portfolio and how is that capital being used to create the kind of world I want?
Well, those are all critical questions that you're asking, Eleanor. And what we've observed is, and I think the last financial crisis, the credit crisis that led to the recession in 2008 and 2009, helped shift some attitudes. You really did see, as you describe, a bifurcated structure, say, within foundations, where you had the investment side of the house and the programmatic side of the house, and you had that 5% versus 95% split. What happened coming out of the recession is that a lot of our clients, their grantees at that time, needed them more than ever. And the need for their capital and their intellectual capital and their financial capital, to be frank, for big foundations was greater than ever. And grants alone weren't going to be able to solve some of the problems. And indeed, grants were under stress where those dollars were needed more than ever, but the ability to generate them based on as a percentage of a base of assets was stressed by, even in the calendar year alone of 2008, on average, endowments went down about 25%. We had a longer period of a stock market going down 50%. So that puts tremendous stress on these pools of assets that generate grant spending. So people started asking themselves questions about how can we be more effective as an enterprise? And we can't think of being a house that's divided between two silos alone, because we ultimately, if we think about risk management in the investment portfolio and we think about risk management with our grant side, and we don't think about how those risks might be related, mm-hmm. Then we're not going to have a healthy operating enterprise. So there have been people went through some serious budget cutting or grant reduction exercises coming out of from 2009 into say 2011, and I think that's also opened their eyes to thinking about taking this whole enterprise view has led to more acceptance of aligning financial capital with some of the programmatic priorities to further impact and not rely on grants alone.
That's encouraging. So you do think more organizations, whether they be foundations in particular or nonprofits even that are working in a mission area, that they are more accepting of aligning their capital with their social mission?
Absolutely. I'll give you a few examples I'll give you three examples of things that I think highlight a distinction of where the market is today and where it could be headed. So mm-hmm. on one hand, there's hundreds of community foundations around the United States, and almost by their design, they should be aligning their capital. That's because they serve as conduits for raising donor-advised funds and taking capital from individuals who might have significant wealth but not enough, say, to start their own private foundation. They channel their giving and their activities through these community foundations. Increasingly, we're seeing those foundations look for aligned investments. Then you have hundreds and hundreds of private foundations around the U.S. that maybe are smaller in size, not your mega foundations. I'll address, say Ford Foundation was my third example. But if you look at foundations with less than $1 billion, you are seeing a lot of them being very progressive in moving toward aligned investment. And so one great example is the Heron Foundation. And they have a great website, which is Heron, HERON.org. They're also a client of mine. They've mm-hmm. been a pioneer in impact investing for 20 years. And they've really thought about this unified approach to how they move dollars out the door. So instead of having two distinct processes and teams, they have one team that looks at everything they're either going to invest in or make a grant to and ask themselves questions about how it furthers their mission.
Oh, fantastic.
And it took a lot of work for them to get there. And then you see a big trend now with the real large pools of capital. I mean, I'll just note, your listeners may be aware that the Ford Foundation, about 2 months ago, made a significant commitment, a public commitment to impact investing, committing $1 billion of its endowment to go into a specific impact pool, which is going to drive their priorities around affordable housing and poverty alleviation in the emerging markets. And that's a lot of money to put to work, and it'll help influence a lot of others in doing so.
That's awesome. So those are some amazing trends you're noting there. And you wrote a great article recently, Understanding the World of Impact Investing, A Practitioner's Perspective on a Growing Field. And in that article, you talk about the size that this market is, or this whole trend, and you say that there's some social and environmental considerations given to $6.6 trillion that was invested in 2014. So that's a couple of years ago. How significant do you think this trend is of impact investing overall, and how much money do you think investors have targeted with some kind of social or environmental focus?
That's a great question. It's a difficult one to put a fine number on. I quote that $6.6 trillion number is a number that comes from a group called USSIF, USSIF, and it's what's formerly called the Forum for Social and Responsible Investment. They've been doing a biannual survey every year since 1985, tracking the broad range of impact investments that we described earlier, from your SRI, your exclusionary screens, to ESG, to impact funds. And there's been significant uptick. I think, I've annualized it since 1985, and I think the compound growth of assets under management that fit some description that this survey captures has been just under 15%, which is a significant steady growth. So I think that trend is certainly continuing. What I've seen are other surveys that where people get very granular in how they'll define what an impact investment is. So you'll see different numbers. So I think the $6 trillion is the broadest possible measure. And I would expect to see that go up similarly as it has in the past, you know, in that trajectory over the next 2 years, or the next year, really, because we got another year until the survey's done, 15%. I think if you look at surveys of investors, if you look at institutional investors, we surveyed a few hundred of our clients recently. We have about 200 clients doing impact investing. And when we surveyed a broad swath of clients, what we saw was that of those that are doing impact investing, they're looking to more than double their allocations to impact investments over the next 5 years.
So wow.
That's significant. That is significant. So a lot of them were in the range of, say, a 25 to 30% of their portfolio. So looking to move up to half of their portfolio into impact investments out of these, you know, 200 or so clients. I think that's a significant indicator. We look at third-party surveys, and you think of millennials and just mm-hmm. individuals who are part of larger families with wealth, and you see tremendous interest in environmental issues and social issues and in impact. And they anticipate that close to 70% of this rising generation is interested in impact investing. So as they move into positions where they have more decision rights over the capital in their trusts or in their family offices, we expect to see a lot more happening on that end too.
Yes. Well, you know, two really important points about what you just mentioned there. One is to point out that when you're an investor, you don't have to put 100% of your portfolio into impact investing. You could do 5%, 10%, you know, some portion of it to try it out and see what you think and to convince yourself about what are the returns in this area. I find it really exciting that your clients are now planning to double their impact and investments over the next 5 years. That's truly awesome. And that's also a vote of confidence that they feel like they're getting good enough returns in it that they feel comfortable increasing the amount of their portfolio that's invested in impact investing. So congratulations on your good work there.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And, you know, in some, it's interesting, you know, in answering the question, I described a broad swath of people in institutions, but what I think you see is everyone approaches it a bit differently, but those that are the furthest along and the most experienced are looking to really align all of their capital. And they do so with patience, because they want to find the best investment opportunities and they don't want to make a bad investment, but it's very progressive and how we're constantly looking for the best ideas. So if there's a part of the portfolio that we don't think is aligned, that's always at the top of the list of things to continue exploring. Is there something that can be done different here? And I think that's the difference. That's the difference between in that progressive yet pragmatic approach, if you will, is the difference between someone who just pays lip service to wanting to do impact and someone who's actually rolling up their sleeves and trying to find a solution that they can incorporate in their portfolio, and if one doesn't exist, asking partners and other investors if they might collaborate to create one.
Right, and that's such a positive trend, too. You know, it's just looking like we're moving from a place where a lot of people, the common thing would be you find your financial investor, and you say, here's the money, and the investor says, okay, well, here's the asset allocation I recommend, and you kind of go with that, and with really very little engagement on the part of the client. But it feels like this is much more activist-oriented, much more engaged, and it's true also. It's a trend I see in philanthropy. It's not just people writing a check, although that's a helpful thing to do. It's that people mm-hmm. will get involved, they'll get in the boards, they'll help out with the organization. They're actually donor participants in the nonprofit. You know, not just someone who's sitting back and writing a check. And I think that whole engagement is exactly what we need to make the kinds of shifts we need in the near term.
I agree. And it's interesting. A lot of my clients invest through investment managers. So, you know, that could be, you know, a mutual fund or, say, a venture capital fund where there's a manager who then is taking the capital and as an intermediary between that capital and the portfolios. And so what our clients are doing is being both very active with the managers about what their expectations are, about the sort of transparency that they would like to have into their investment portfolio, understand what they own and why. I mean, I think those two questions, what do I own and why, are key for any impact investor. And then there are increased opportunities. There's certainly great impact you can have by being an active owner of a company. So with the advent of SRI, there certainly was also the advent of shareholder activism, and we've seen steady growth and progress in that area too. I think with the most notable event in recent weeks even has been at the shareholder meeting for Exxon, where 62% of shareholders voted in a non-binding resolution, mind you, but voted nonetheless and sent a strong signal saying they wanted greater disclosure around carbon and climate-related issues. So there's a lot of different ways you can be engaged and activist, both with public and private companies.
Yes, that's an excellent point. I want to come back to that in a minute, but just to follow the thread on the millennials that you mentioned about 70% of millennials being interested in impact investment, the World Economic Forum says that there's $51 trillion being handed to millennials and the biggest ever intergenerational transfer of wealth. And I think the combination of the fact that these millennials are coming, they're going to inherit more wealth than any other generation ever in history, and that you're saying 70% of those millennials are interested in some form of impact investment, that's a very encouraging trend.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's no way to shade it any differently. And it's been consistent in the conversations we've had both with our clients. We every 2 years, for example, we have a conference with what we call the next generation of this millennial generation rising. And it's been consistent over the last decade. Every time we have this such a gathering, the most popular topic is impact investing.
Really?
Yes. We see that, and it just reflects what we see in the surveys of others who also work with millennials. So we see that coming. At the same time, I would suggest that, one, you read those comments about the transfer of wealth. You know, you can get the wrong impression that there's some sort of lock or gate of which all this will pass through at one time. This is going to happen over a longer period of time. And I think there are people that have been leaders in this field for a long time. And in fact, there are some of the most thoughtful, engaged people and pioneering people I know in this field that are many generations older than the millennials and still doing this. But I think gratifying to see such a groundswell of support coming with this rising generation.
Yeah, it's very encouraging. Now, I want to get back to what you mentioned about the shareholder action. I mean, in addition to directing the funds to enable companies to grow, the ones doing the right thing, there's also the opportunity for shareholder activity. And I found it really interesting that the Exxon shareholder vote that you mentioned, kind of pushing Exxon, that the shareholders are pushing ExxonMobil to be more transparent and more proactive around what they're doing with the climate change and all that, that vote was reported in the newspaper the same day that the President Trump announced he was going to pull out of the Paris Accord and the Paris Agreement. So, you know, it goes to the point of we can't control a lot of what the President or Congress does, but we can use the power we have, the power of our money, to be able to make the kinds of changes that we need to have happen. And that, in fact, just like there was a movement in the 1970s to divest from investment in South Africa to stop apartheid, that today now there's a movement to divest from fossil fuel companies, the companies that are in oil, gas, and coal, and that whole movement has some traction. What do you see happening there?
Well, the fossil fuel divestment movement has been a very powerful force for several years now. And it's certainly been provided a strong tailwind, if you will, toward what we've been talking about thus far this hour about the growth of impact investing. So I would say there's a few things. I think that the fossil fuel divestment movement, one, adopted the energy and enthusiasm of the millennials that we've just been describing, and married that with some of the experience that people had forged in the 1970s around South Africa and thinking about social activism. So it was really an activist movement, and it targeted the investment portfolios. We didn't see widespread divestment per se, but what we did see were some high-profile divestments. We have some very large, notable clients, for example, that are divesting their portfolio from fossil fuels, and primarily of the holders of the largest reserves of fossil fuels. You know, and they made a really strong argument that if the temperature of the Earth is not to rise more than 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, then we cannot burn all of this carbon. And that argument has built to shape some really credible economic discussions around investment portfolios. It's also activated policy discussions and public interest. And so that's been huge. Where I think divestment ran into some challenges is that sometimes discussions will get only focused on the divestment side and really the supply side of the equation, if you will, of energy. Where one could argue the real challenge for our climate, our planet, is the demand side and our consumption of it. And so where it's evolved now is to people not only talking about divestment, but also this proactive investment in some of the environmental sustainability themes I discussed earlier. So divestment, I think I would expect with the current administration deciding to not support the Paris Climate Agreement, which is a very sensible, well-framed agreement around the importance of the dangers of climate change and acting on those, that you will probably see a resurgence in the activist community around this and talking about these issues. I think it's interesting, however, that even as President Trump decided to essentially ignore and leave Paris on the side of the road, if you will, you had even some of the largest fossil fuel companies like Exxon saying they thought that was a bad idea. So we're in a different world even today than we were, say, 5 or 6 years ago when Bill McKibben and 350.org started generating the real initial strong inroads from the fossil fuel divestment movement.
Yeah, and I love that combination that, yes, we'll do the divestment from the fossil fuels like we did from the apartheid companies in South Africa, but at the same time also do the investment in the companies that are doing the right thing. So, I love that combination. That's a real powerful 1-2 punch.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So it's, And if you'll allow me to just comment a bit more on the Paris Agreement.
Yeah, go ahead.
With President Trump deciding to leave that, to not support Paris, you know, he's essentially working against what's been a strong market signal where 80% of the world's GDP in Paris in 2015 agreed to lower carbon emissions. That's a strong economic signal. And indeed, some of the largest other economies are staying in the agreement and even reaffirming with great strength their commitment to it since the United States has said they won't participate. And when we just look at the underlying economic fundamentals across these impact markets I described earlier, particularly with things like renewable energy and things that will really drive lower carbon emissions, they still make great economic sense. So our clients and investors aren't really deterred by the news in recent weeks about Paris.
Yeah, that's very encouraging. And then, of course, we have some of the states within the United States saying we're going to abide by the Paris Agreement anyway. I mean, big states like California and New York and my home state of Massachusetts, I'm very proud, said yes, even with a Republican governor, Charlie Baker, saying we're going to abide by the Paris Agreement. So I think it's where the trend is. I think the president is putting some drag on that forward momentum, but it's going to go forward nevertheless.
Yes. Yeah. I'd say probably shorter term speed bump. And then a lot of what the administration is doing in general from a policy perspective is pushing decisions more down to the states. And so we've seen, you know, strong support for renewable portfolio and renewable power standards across most of the states. And maybe not surprisingly, in the world that we live in today, it's about half the states are very pro-renewables and half are more neutral on the topic.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you mentioned, you know, some of these unlikely suspects coming out in favor of the Paris Agreement. Like, who would have predicted ExxonMobil would say, yes, we should abide by the Paris Agreement? And, you know, it gives good rules of the road for the certainty for companies trying to operate globally to know what is going to happen. So that was very striking to me. And it also hit me when I attended, you probably know the group Ceres, C-E-R-E-S, that encourages, you know, this whole concept of social and environmental responsible use of funds and investments. When I was at that conference, there were some, you know, industry leaders that you'd expect, like the socially conscious Ben & Jerry's and Stonyfield Yogurt. But what surprised me most was the high-level participation of some of the Fortune 500 companies like PepsiCo and General Motors and Levi Strauss. And who do you see as some of the unlikely suspects at a big scale who are involved in the impact investing?
From a corporate level?
Yes. Anybody?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I mean, you know, as far as when we look at companies that are rated by common measures of, say, ESG metrics, it might not be surprising to know, but I think is for some, that there are some companies that are involved in extraction, such as integrated oil companies or mining companies or companies that are doing heavy industry, that they are paying the greatest attention to environmental and governance risks and some of the social risks and how they're treating their workforce. Because they're often working in, they could be working in emerging economies, you know, they are doing activities that could be dangerous to the earth and dangerous to people. So common sense would say they should be much more safety conscious and aware of that. And that's where I think speaks to what we're seeing on the proactive side of finding the best-in-class type companies across the economy. However, we have clients that would still like to avoid investing in some of those, so they wouldn't look at those. I think on the consumer side, you know, we just have a rising consumer base across the world. So when you think of global companies, you mentioned Ben & Jerry's, you think of a Unilever, which owns Ben & Jerry's, and how they think about the sustainability of their brands, their voice, and their communication around social impact and environmental impact. I think those big consumer conglomerates are going to be even more important than they in the future than they are today, because we're going to have a rising consumer class in all these other countries.
Yeah, very good. And I'm wondering, in case some of our listeners are interested in kind of taking this a step further with impact investing themselves, if someone comes to you and says, I'd like to explore this, what do you do? Do you have like a questionnaire they fill out and they kind of check the boxes of what areas are of most interest to them? Or, you know, walk us through what would happen to a person interested in exploring impact investing.
Well, the good news is there's no shortage of information out there right now. So for an individual, I think it's very helpful to go and explore the websites of some of the organizations we've already mentioned, such as Ceres, if you're interested in environmental issues, or the U.S. CIF, or the Global Impact Investing Network, the GIN, as they call it. There's a lot of publicly available and free information that helps orient people around what are the key issues, what are some key questions you should ask yourself, and provide some frameworks for organizing your thinking. Because just like many investing topics, there can be an overwhelming amount of information. So that is key. As we work with institutions, it's a similar process, but they often have a governing body, say a board of directors, an investment committee, and a lot of it is just engaging in dialogue up front to ensure we're level setting, giving people a common understanding and a common dialogue around the topic, and frankly allowing people to test some of their own assumptions or presumptions challenge them in a manner where they're not feel like they're forced to make an investment decision. So if they are unburdened with decisions for a day, I think we can get a lot done on learning and education. If there's a decision that needs to be made right up front, i.e., here's this impact stuff, I don't believe in it, I don't understand it, and you want me to make an investment in a fund, you're not going to get a good result. So what I tell people, if there's any cost to impact investing, it's investing that time up front to level set and learn.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that goes back to what we were talking about. It takes a little bit more engagement on the part of the investor to really think through what are your values, what are you looking to do, what's out there that you could invest in. So it's not as easy to just say, okay, well, I'll do a standard and poor 500 index fund and drop my money in that.
Well, that's right, Eleanor. I think of it this way. Investing ultimately is a good investor likes to think that they're availing themselves of all the available information to make the best decision possible. And what we've seen with impact investing and in SRI to ESG to impact is that a whole lot of new information has come into the marketplace and some people have refused to engage with it. And a lot of it's very valuable. It gives you insights you're missing. So if you're an so what I say is it's investing but harder because you have to reach out and incorporate all this new information into your thinking, and that's what we've been doing.
Mm-hmm. Great. And you mentioned at the beginning of the show that thinking of the historical progression of some kind of socially responsible investing, that this was actually used back in colonial times. And I was really curious to know historically what you see as the roots in the United States for this kind of conscious investing.
Okay, I will hazard an answer with no doubt that I'm sure a historian will call you'll get an email or I'm tripped up. But what I've seen is, I think if you really go back to, it was really religious driven. So some of the Puritans coming over, and it was very much exclusionary, as you can might imagine, particularly anti-vices. So, churches had some amount of money and would invest in local enterprises, and so it was not investing in, say, tobacco or gambling and all of the things that they thought would lead to the ruination of their flock, if you will. I hesitate to give any one person specific credit because I'm sure I would get it that wrong because there wasn't just one person.
Yeah. Well, I think, the point being that over time we've seen the power of money to influence and guide in good ways and bad, and that it's really come now to a place where it's very sophisticated. And moving from the exclusionary of I'm not going to do the tobacco and alcohol that's going to bring the church members down, but moving into I will invest in this company that's working, to save the wetlands or to promote renewable energy. It was just like an endless array of potential companies you could invest in. And I think it's a very exciting time in the world to be alive, to be able to see those possibilities and make those choices with your capital.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I was really excited about what you said, that a lot of this has been done now mostly through major individuals and institutions, but that the real cutting edge is going to be increasing the access to impact investing to individual investors. So talk a little bit about what you see happening with that.
So it's not where I inhabit, it's not where I spend my day to day because I'm still working with the institutions, the individuals. But what I see happening is through, say, the venture capital and the private equity community, some pretty notable investments being made into technology-driven companies that are helping provide solutions in this area. So they're either creating brokerage platforms or partnering with existing brokers to provide analysis and information to help people pick good impact or ESG investments. You are seeing an increased number of ESG options and alternatives with some of the more traditional players like a Vanguard or a Fidelity, who tend to offer a lot of retirement plans, but are increasing the amount of funds that they have to offer to people that could do this. And where I think it's ultimately headed is with retirement plans. The people that oversee their employees' retirement plans are held up to some pretty strict fiduciary standards. And coming out of the crisis, one thing that they've all been focusing on is, one, lowering the fees, so it's moving to more passive-type investments, and making sure people have good advice. And so that's where people are coming in with an increasing range of passive impact investments and advice that helps people pick these. And those things are getting layered into some of these retirement plans. Not everyone's there yet, but it's moving quite rapidly. And I imagine if we checked in another 2 years on this, we'd see some much wider adoption.
That's really exciting. And also, of course, our listeners as individuals can talk to their religious group or church or a foundation they might be connected to, or a nonprofit organization they're a member of, and encourage them to use their portfolio to do impact investing, at least some portion of it.
Sure. And I would, speaking of, you know, where there are places that there are just information out there, there's a group called Impact Assets, which, you know, I'm not endorsing everything they pick, but they come out with a top 50 list every year of some of the best impact investments. And this is things that are available for both institutions and some individuals. So that's free as well. And people should start paying attention and tracking and see what those are. And that's a good starting place to start digging in and seeing, you know, understanding the nuances and the different characteristics of these opportunities and how they might fit with how someone wants to invest.
Fantastic. Well, that's all the time we have. Tom Mitchell, thank you so much for being with us today and for all your work in directing capital to create the kind of country and world we want.
And thank you, Eleanor, and thanks for the great conversation and all the great conversations you have with your listeners.
Thank you. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.